Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, about 2 years ago, I interviewed a fiction author who always weaves a thread of history through his novels. And in this case, the book was called The King's Deception, and it was inspired by a story that many apparently believe to be true. The author was Steve Berry. Talked with him several times on the show, and he said that extensively, about his research that he did for this book in Britain. He talked with docents and history buffs, and they all agreed that not only was the king duped, but the whole of the British Empire was duped. So we're going to learn more about that later on with an expert that I found on this subject to find out, is this fact or is this really fiction? And his name is Matthew Lyons. He's a British historian and the author of The Favourite. But first, I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Jay Richards. He's a forensic psychologist specializing in the evaluation and treatment of violent offenders. In the field of criminal psychology, he's known for groundbreaking research, provocative theoretical papers, and insightful case studies of mentally disordered offenders. He has a really impressive background. His 3 decades of experience diagnosing and studying psychopaths and sex offenders has provided him, as you might imagine, with plenty of authentic material for his new psychological thriller, and that is called Silhouette of Virtue. Dr. Jay Richards, welcome.
Thank you, Vicki.
Very pleased to have you here. And I want to kick off by, last night I started watching it anyway. It's called Stonehurst Asylum, and Ben Kingsley is the medical director of an asylum, and he asks a visiting doctor, why do you want to practice asylum medicine? And the visiting doctor said, I've always been fascinated by the troubled mind. Ben Kingsley replied, well, so is a priest, but at least he's guaranteed heaven. What do you expect to gain? And the doctor replied, the satisfaction of helping those in hell. Of all the afflictions, I can think of none more cruel than madness, sir. So what is your response to why psychology and why forensic psychology in particular?
Why psychology is I was an undergraduate student in the English department writing and wanting to be a writer. And my professors kept saying, you know, you really write like a psychologist more than a literary person. Why don't you think about doing psychology? And I was interested in it. And I started pursuing psychology as a career in graduate school. So that's why psychology generally. But I've always been interested in the motivation for extreme acts. And not just crime, but even extreme accomplishment, positive accomplishment, self-actualization. That's interesting to me, too. But in the criminal world, when you have people who repeat, more than once commit serious crimes or bizarre crimes, they're just intrinsically interesting scientifically and clinically, and you have to put together a narrative, a story mm-hmm. of how this person came to be and why they're driven to do these things. So I think it combines both that interest in psychology and in putting together stories.
And we were talking before we came live today. Obviously, there's a huge interest in that, judging on the number of CSI-type programs that we see today that look not into just the act, but the why behind the act of things. And, you know, and that's something that fascinates me, too. And I want to just define a couple of terms here, if we can. I read Dr. Martha Stout's book, The Sociopath Next Door, a couple of years back. And she said that we now use the word psychopath and sociopath interchangeably. Would you agree with that?
I don't think we should at all. A sociopath, I understand, to be someone whose criminal tendencies have been socialized, in other words, through the normal process of growth and maturity and nurture, they've become to adopt criminal values and criminal ideals. They have criminal heroes. they have a criminal social network. Those people, those sociopaths, if they're moved into a different environment, they will adjust and become much more normal. In other words, they have adjusted to a crime-oriented, antisocial environment. The psychopath is less likely to have the emotional range to make an adjustment like that. They don't really need the nurture so much. It's much more nature, as far as we can understand it now. There are brain differences, physiological differences in the psychopath. Certainly, we believe that early childhood experience of neglect and abuse makes it more likely that a child with the right genetic background will become a psychopath. But the tendency is for us to think that about 60% of the likelihood of becoming a severe psychopath is genetic.
That's, that's interesting, 60%. How many do you, she also said in her book that she, I believe it was one in three, was like a lot of people that she'd put in that sociopathic group there, which seems really high to me, but of course I'm not a scientist or psychologist.
Well, the psychopaths, interestingly enough, they have about the same number of psychopaths as we have people with schizophrenia, about 2% of the male population and a smaller percent of the female population, which is true of schizophrenia too. So that makes many of us think that psychopathy is a serious brain disorder like schizophrenia. If you go to prisons, about 70% will fit the diagnosis for antisocial personality disorder, which is much very similar to the sociopath. So I would agree with her that about 70% of prisoners have some sort of disorder, but I believe that's mainly through a life experience and nurture. And then about up to 20%, depending on how the prison environment, maximum security prison, for example, up to 20% of those people will be high on psychopathy. They'll have this biological trait, brain differences, emotional differences, and they'll understand words in a different way, emotional words in a very different way than a normal person.
Interesting. So you certainly have, over the three decades, collected a lot of fodder for your writing. I read that you had always dabbled in writing. So talk to us a little bit about that. Did you write as a kid, or was it more as an adult?
Right. And thinking about this, I recall that in grade school, I guess I might have had a little of this antisocial tendency. So I got in trouble, and the teacher sent me home to write, a one sentence like 1,000 times over the weekend. And instead, I wrote a story about Jason and the Argonauts, and I turned it in. I said, "Well, it's 1,000 lines. It's just as it's just as much." And she wasn't happy. I broke the rule again. But yeah, all throughout my life, and I think maybe because as a child I would get attention by telling jokes, and or I would say something clever around the TV set, related to what was going on. So I got rewarded for it.
Right.
But I've always in my 20s I wrote poetry. And was very interested in being a poet. And then I found out, well, poets don't make a living. I don't know if that's true. And so I started steering towards psychology. And then I started appreciating the novel as being a complex structure that can do things that probably no other art form can do. And I'm sure every kind of art feels that way. But I think the novel is unique in what it can do, and so I've been gravitating toward the novel.
Mm. And it's obviously you do a lot of writing in your work. You write a lot of papers. Your background, I wasn't kidding when I said it's impressive. You worked with the National Institute for Mental Health. You've worked with the White House on some cases. You've been the director of Special Commitment Center. I mean, there's a lot in your background that is really, really impressive. It's one thing writing papers on the work you do. It's a whole other thing putting out a story that you've written yourself. And I was interested to read in an article in an interview that you said that you used to write, sometimes you were too serious to open up and create without perpetual harsh self-criticism. At some point, I decided to act on the old injunction, physician, heal thyself. I stepped away from my perfectionism and got down to work. And I think that perfectionism holds a lot of creative people back. So I wonder if you'd share your insight into that and how you dealt with that, especially as a psychologist.
Right. I think I had an obstacle in the way as being a psychologist, actually, because I was trained to do a certain kind of writing, academic writing, and then professional writing for the courts. And that kind of writing is very careful. It has to be very clear. It always has to be correct. If you think you might not be right, then you have to put in caveats and, you know, refer people in footnotes and that
right,
sort of thing.
Right.
So it's a very cautious kind of thing. And when you dare to be creative, usually the editors of a journal will send it back and say, well, this is a little too daring. Why don't you be a little more conservative in what mm-hmm. you're saying? Whereas in writing fiction, you have to press the limits for a couple of reasons. Otherwise, you don't get to your own emotional material, and it'll be boring. It won't be interesting to people. I think that inner critic is the hardest thing to deal with, and I think first is facing the reality that art at its best is about pushing the limits. It's the limits of your own joy, the limits of your own fear, the limits of the things that you find odious or difficult. And if you don't push those limits, you won't have much to offer anyone else. You might do yourself a little therapy or divert yourself for a while, but it won't be a work of value. So I think coming to terms of why you're doing this and that it is part of a contribution and not just a self-expression.
Mm-hmm.
And then that takes the focus off the self and more on the work of art as an object that can be useful to people or useful in the world.
Right. That's interesting. And I was talking with a friend about this and about your book, and he said that he has this moment of sheer panic every time he submits to his editor. And if he doesn't have that moment of sheer panic, what he's written usually isn't as good as it could be.
That makes sense to me.
It's pushing yourself, as you said. Well, we need to take a quick break. My guest in this segment is Jay Richards, Dr. Jay Richards. His new book is called Silhouette of Virtue, and we're going to learn a little about this book in the next segment. We're not going to give it all away. Please do stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Whispering Dragon in Seattle, we cover the world of animals. This week, March 8th, it's a Talk with Your Animals Sunday on Animal World. Gifted animal communicator and medium Darcy Pariso joins me in the studio. Darcy can help you talk with your current animal friends, and she can connect you with animal or human loved ones on the other side. Open phone lines throughout the show, so plan to call in early. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, stop self-sabotage once and for all by taming your outer child with psychotherapist Susan Anderson. Also, Vicky talks food junkies and the truth about food addiction with medical director Dr. Vera Tarman. Keep up with show news on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And be sure and tune in every Monday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Feed your mind and your body and spirit will follow. Alternative Talk 1150.
Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. We are talking with Dr. Jay Richards, a Seattle forensic psychologist here who's specializing He specializes in the evaluation and treatment of violent offenders, and that's given him plenty of material to write his new psychological thriller, Silhouette of Virtue, and that's what we're going to talk about in this next segment. So Dr. Richards, fill us in on the story, if you would. It's 1973. It's a small college town in southern Illinois, and there's a series of rapes going on, targeting specifically Asian women.
Yes, and the rapist tells each victim that this is payback for Vietnam. He's framing it as sort of a protest act. And these crimes, of course, terrorize everybody. And eventually, one of the instructors, who's an African-American drama instructor, is arrested for these crimes. The only other black instructor on the campus is a philosophy professor, Dr. Nathan Rivers. And Dr. Rivers really isn't very close to the person who's been accused, but the students advocate, help him or he won't get a fair trial. And eventually, Dr. Rivers supports this person and actually puts up some money to aid his defense. And then he starts finding information that suggests that this other black professor, Calvert Duncan, may be guilty or involved in some ways in these crimes. And Dr. Rivers becomes an amateur sleuth while he's balancing his academic duties to try to find out what is really going on.
And the evidence is really slim, but Rivers really, and Rivers, even though he's going to be the sleuth and he mortgages his house to help support, he still has doubt himself about this. So what was his motivation in doing that?
Well, I think he has motivation on a couple levels. One is the students are advocating that he do it, and they want to make Rivers their hero, the progressive students on the campus. This is the time of the war protests and students taking over administrations and that sort of thing. Rivers thinks he's immune to that, but no one's really immune to people praising you and thinking you're wonderful. And then on another level, he's aware of discrimination and racism, and he sees how this crime fits in to how what many people would want to see the perpetrator of these crimes being a African American, fitting a stereotype that, you know, in southern Illinois was not rare stereotype.
Right, right.
And I think the other motivation is one he's struggling with is that he's never made a decision that he can't back away from. The mother of his daughter is common-law wife. He never commits to her. She's a white woman from an upper-class background.
Which back then was quite significant. Now we wouldn't blink an eye, but back in the 70s.
Right, especially in the South. I mean, southern Illinois is the South.
Right,
people
right.
have been down there. It would be something that would raise eyebrows, even in an academic environment. So he hasn't made a commitment even to his wife. He's committed to his child because there's a biological commitment.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't ever neglect the child. But this opportunity, he sees it as an opportunity, strangely enough, to make a decision and to commit to something that he can't easily back away. And he quickly starts to feel like this might have been the wrong thing to try to take a stand in midlife. He's trying to take a midlife stand. He's in his late 30s.
Right. I read that you based your characters on several different people, not one person, but a conglomeration, if you will. Is there any of you in there at all?
Oh, I think so, definitely, in several of the characters. But I think in Dr. Rivers, I think the interest in philosophy and living the life, a life informed by philosophy and by the spirit of art, by your better lights, better angels, and trying to do that consistently. It's certainly something I don't do as gracefully as Dr. Rivers does, and I hope I don't make as many bad decisions and
right.
big errors. So in fiction, the part of me that's like him can do that, make the bad errors and do some things very gracefully. But I think that, parts of yourself gets dispersed, and another part of myself that's there is a love of nature. So although this book occurs, there's scenes in Chicago, in the gay bar scene in Chicago, and there's scenes on the campus, which is small, mm-hmm. In a small university town. Some of the most important action happens in this huge national forest, the Shawnee National Forest, which here in the Northwest, we're used to big forests around, but this is a huge forest that has a great history for the especially for Native Americans. It was part of the Trail of Tears fact, more Native Americans died in that part of Illinois than any other part of the journey on the Trail of Tears. They spent a full winter there fighting the federal troops. And I connect with that. I think Rivers connects with it, and it plays sort of a not straightforward role in how the action plays out in the novel. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. I want to read this. You said that in your work as a psychologist, you sit when you're doing forensic assessment and forensic therapy with dangerous people, you sit for long, long periods of silence across the table from your patient. And sometimes that's just an empty void there. You say this is great writing practice, learning how to sit with powerful emotion, those of your own, those of your patient, those of your character. Talk to us a little bit about what that's like for you, getting your emotion out on the paper. I think that's often where people struggle, too, when they're used to doing, you know, strict nonfiction and then come to fiction.
Right. I think the advantage of fiction is that you have the protection of the character. So that when you're expressing that emotion, you're not writing, you know, like, for example, when I was courting my wife, if I wrote her a love poem, it would be nobody but me. And so it's sort of embarrassing. You know, everything you write seems over the top or, you know, too flowery. But when you're writing fiction and you have a character, you have the distance of the character, and you're trying to understand, you're trying to hear that character, you're trying to feel that character's emotion. And I think that's liberating. Because you're using that creative vehicle of the character. And, of course, it opens up things about yourself, and it opens up life experiences that otherwise you wouldn't have access to. For example, if one of the characters in this book is based on two people I knew. One was a patient in a psychiatric hospital, and another was a childhood friend. And by exploring those characters, it opened up what I knew about their emotional lives and my own experience of them that I couldn't have experienced any other way. I couldn't have recalled how I felt at age 8 or 10 when I saw this friend do some really cruel things that were hard to consider. But by putting that part of that person in a character, I could get both to my reactions and to what was going on with him, at least as far as my capacity could take me.
Right. You said that you believe fiction, like all the arts, is a mode of knowledge. It's valuable because it allows us to feel and perceive in new ways. Getting through your first fiction book here, how did you feel you changed or opened up differently?
Boy, that's a great question.
Would I make a good psychologist?
Oh, you definitely would. You'd make an excellent psychologist. I won't leave you with long silences, though. I think I changed. I have a greater awareness of the power of language and that ideas are as much alive in the words as they are in our thoughts, and that paying a really close attention to words, to images and imagery in any kind of writing, and learning much more about what kind of creatures we are. I think I'm much more aware that our symbolic selves are just so important. You know, our physical selves are here, but that we really live in symbols. And I think I did more lip service to that before finishing this book.
Mm-hmm. A lot of books, you know, there's a key theme running through, which of course there is in yours. There's a couple of different, because you've mentioned some of the things that you're interested in. Let's talk about a take-home message, because I don't think you certainly don't beat the reader over the head with this message, but you say that the real world around us is a terrifying, beautiful, mysterious place, and we're part and parcel of that world. Talk to us a little about that, if you would.
Well, I think the way I frame that, there's a anthropologist named Ernest Becker, who was working in University of British Columbia. And he developed a theory called the denial of death, that the secret of human culture is that we can't face the fact that we're going to die, and that we constantly are aware of it. We're the only animals that are aware that we're going to die. And so we do a lot of mechanisms, mental mechanisms and social mechanisms to control that. Well, Becker speaks very powerfully to the terrible part of life, which is that we all will die. Everybody we love, and that death is painful and it's messy. That part of it. And he also speaks to mystery, that as we try to understand why we're here and what we're doing, we run into mystery. Even whatever our belief system is, mm-hmm. There's a gap between our belief and what we experience. And I think that the beautiful part is the part that sustains us. You know, it's the part that constantly takes us next, to the next, taking the next step. And when I say beautiful, you know, we see that beauty in the people we love. We see that beauty in the places we have allegiance to, that we feel rooted in. So it's for me, that the beautiful is also a synonym for good and true and worthy. And I think that those things are what I want the reader to try to look at, both in the world I've created, in their own world, and within themselves. And maybe the hardest part to look at for some people is the terrible side of themselves. But for other people, it'll be the beautiful side.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it'll be hard. Or the mystery. Some people think they know each other. They know themselves very well. I'm this kind of person. And so I would hope that the message that the reader would get, there's actually a chapter in the book titled, "Do You Ever Really Know Anyone?"
Yeah, do we?
And I would say no, because there's a mystery. There is a mystery there. We might know a lot. We might feel very intimately close to them. But there's a mystery in the other person and in us.
I would agree with that. I've come to that conclusion that we never really know anybody else, even though we think we do. So I heard, maybe this is true, maybe it's not, that there may be another book in the works following this?
Yes. I actually have two projects, and the one is more autobiographical. This book is not. There is something that's historical in it, in that it's based on some real crimes that happened at a university I was at. But other than that, it's not autobiographical. But the project I'm working on now is about a year I spent in Nigeria back in the 70s again. It's a formative period in my life. And it was a year of adventure. I went there to teach actually the African novel and British novel, Pride and Prejudice, and, you know, Things Fall Apart in the same course. And so it sort of goes through some experiences I had there, but the framework is exploring the development of a poet, and that's based on the writer Leon Forrest, is an African-American writer who passed away back in 85.
Okay. Well, we'll look forward to that, and I thank you, Dr. J. Richards, for being with us today. The book is called Silhouette of Virtue, a psychological thriller here. The Chicago Life magazine said this is a wonderful book with a dramatic ending. It was hard to put down even for a few hours. I was immersed in the ambience of the art world and the campus life during the Watergate years. So job well done.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And you can find out more about Jay and his work at jrichardsbooks.com, jrichardsbooks.com. Well, please do stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live, and we will be right back.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you, at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
On the AM band at 1150 and on the FM HD band at 98.9 HD3. Alternative Talk 1150.
I never thought I would get to this place, but the truth.
And welcome back, everyone. And you are listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And as the music said there, we are going to hear the truth right now. Today, in this segment, I hope we're going to answer a question that was raised in a show a couple of years ago, actually, with novelist Steve Berry. He's sold millions of books. He is a fiction author, and I've interviewed him many times. But that led me to connecting with my guest, who's now going to join us in the studio, on the phone here. And I'll explain a little more as we go along. Let me tell you who my guest is. He is Matthew Lyons, a historian and writer with particular interest in the early modern period. He has an MA in Renaissance Literature, and his most recent book is The Favourite, a study of the relationship between Elizabeth I and Walter Raleigh. Previous books include Impossible Journeys and There and Back Again in the Footsteps of J.R.R. Tolkien. Matthew's contributed articles to a wide range of publications. He's a columnist for History Today magazine and has been heard many times on BBC Radio. And he's currently working on a book about the dissolution of the monasteries. Matthew Lyons, welcome.
Thank you very much. Nice to talk to you, Vicki.
And to you too. We've connected via email a couple of times last year, and I want to just let listeners know how we connected and why we connected. So I mentioned that I had Steve Berry. He's been on the show several times. He is a novelist. He's a law professor and a novelist, and always weaves some thread of history through his novels as a subplot. And in this particular case, we're talking about a book called The King's Deception, where he said that Henry VIII was duped into believing that his daughter, Queen Elizabeth, was really Queen Elizabeth. Other people are saying Elizabeth died as a child and she was replaced by a boy because they feared retribution from King Henry VIII. And so that's the king's deception, that he you know, raised this child thinking it was a girl, and they're saying, no, it was really a boy. You know, it kind of played on my mind on and off, and I was browsing through the internet one night. I came across a blog which led to another blog which led to a really well-written post by Matthew Lyons. And so I emailed Matthew and said, hey, have you heard this rumor that Queen Elizabeth I wasn't really a woman, that she was a man. And you said what, Matthew?
I said that's just not true, or worse than effect. I may not have been quite as polite as that. it's something for which there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever. And I think even if you stop to think about it for a little while, it the absurdity of it ought to kind of strike you as much too implausible. I'm not saying that it isn't a great book that is written against deception, but I think it has to be firmly labelled as fiction rather than fact.
Yeah, and at the time when this came out, and there was a lot of publicity around the book, and again, I do want to stress it's a novel, but, yeah. You know, Barry did say when he talked with me, there's definite cause for doubt here. But there were many, many articles written, and maybe not by, you know, the New York Times, but by the Daily Mail in England publications like that, definitely brought this into question and brought forward what they said was evidence of this. And in fact, in the village of Bilsley, which is where Elizabeth was sent as a child to stay away from the plague and everything that was happening, they have a festival every year.
Yes, I believe they have a festival where someone carries a... Is it a boy dressed as a woman or a woman dressed as a man? It's a boy dressed as a woman, isn't it?
Yeah, a boy dressed as a woman.
Yeah, and this is meant to kind of represent in folklore the occasion on which, you know, the boy from the village took Elizabeth's place in her household. Just to start with that as a starting point, the thesis is that this is the top secret thing that no one knew about and had to be kept hush hush and so on. In which case, it seems highly unlikely that it will be celebrated in a village every year for
right.
400 years. I mean, that's just one observation. I mean, you know, there were so many things. I mean, one thing would be that Elizabeth, you know, spoke and wrote Latin and Greek and a whole range of other languages from a very young age. The idea that a young boy, even an educated young boy, could step into that role overnight, let alone an uneducated, presumably not literate or barely literate boy from a village could take her place, is just fantastical. And then obviously, you know, as you go on through her life, obviously I assume that the idea is that they, faked her dress and so on, and that there were people around her / him who knew the secret and who connived at it. But I mean, it's hard to overstress how much Elizabeth's life and the life of other royalty or people at court was public. I mean, she was on display in most respects almost the entire time, and obviously, as you know, there are any number of marriage tutors who were put across her path, sometimes willingly and sometimes not, you know, from various European courts. And two members of the French royal family were came over to possibly woo her hand in marriage, various princes from Sweden. There were people like the Earl of Leicester who apparently knew her since she was 8. I mean, they were in the tower together at one point, although it's not certain that they would have met then. When they were both in the tower during Mary's reign, but certainly he knew her from a very young age. And as I mentioned in the favourite, there were all sorts of scholar stories about Elizabeth through her life, really, from very early age. Absolutely none of them are about her being a boy. So plenty of stories about her having children, illicit children, and having affairs. Stemming really from the fact that she didn't marry, you know,
right.
Which is a very odd decision for that period. It's relatively unusual now. In that period, very unusual, and for a monarch, one of whose key jobs is to ensure that there's someone to hand the crown on to, it's you know, revolutionary as an idea. So I mean, that caught people's attention as being strange, and I suppose as a particularly powerful royal figure. I mean, she's by all accounts a very commanding person. intellectually and in terms of her relationships with the courtiers and so on. The idea that she might also therefore be, I suppose, sexually demanding, if you want to put it like that, but you know, her to not be feminine in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you know, I can't stress enough about how public her role was, and I mean, again, as I say in the book, I mean, she was much spied upon by all the courts in Europe.
Right.
Well, the Spanish had a spy in her laundry, were checking on her menstrual cycle to see whether maybe she was pregnant, maybe she wasn't. You know,
right.
was she fit to marry? If she did marry, could she have children? So, I mean, the level of detail of plotting that one would have to do to pretend that there was a man as a woman, it beggars belief. And then, you know, later on in her life, there was a fashion to really, I think in the last decade of her life, for a fashion at court for women to have their breasts exposed in the dress. Again, that would be very difficult to fake,
right.
I would have thought, even with, you know, cosmetics now.
Right.
Never mind in 1597.
Well, I went back through a couple of the articles that came out around, you know, the
yeah.
two that came out a couple of years ago and looked
yeah.
at other stuff too. And I know, of course, you're the expert on this, but it seemed to me that they just took things out of context. Like, she was a strong woman. She knew as a child she didn't want to get married. And, you know, Henry
yeah.
VIII was her dad. I mean, surely that put her off marriage for, you know, good reason.
Yeah, yeah. If your dad has your mum's head cut off when you're three, I imagine that you know is going to be years of therapy, if there were such thing as therapy.
And she was exceptionally
yeah.
exceptionally bright and calculating, even from a young age, as you said. And you know,
yeah.
as you said, for a young boy uneducated from the village to come in and replicate that, it seems very far fetched. But I wanted to just. Mention this because Bram Stoker put her in, I think he included her in the book called Imposters. He
yeah.
was convinced, Bram Stoker, of course, who wrote Dracula, was convinced
yeah.
that she was a man and included her in the book called Imposters based on what he
yeah.
thought was, you know, evidence. But there was no hardcore evidence.
Yeah, I think Bram Stoker is pretty much responsible for the story, as far as I'm aware. I'm not aware of it, whether it you know, circulated anecdotally or not beforehand. But I'm not aware of it being in print before he put it down. He takes a few kind of stray quotes from you know, courtiers' letters or letters from her household. I think one actually from Raleigh's aunt, Cat Champernowne, who was Elizabeth's governess, about. I can't remember the quote exactly, but it's something about if people knew the real, you know, if people knew what was going on in the household, they would be shocked, sort of quote. And I think Stoker's taken that and run with it quite
right.
a long way
right.
and tied it together with you know, the boy story from, is it Bilsley?
Yes, Bilsley. Is it Bilsley or Bilsley?
Yeah.
I wasn't sure if that was a typo on the print that I saw. But yeah, and I think another thing that was sent around causing speculation and that people kind of jumped on was she had a tutor named Robert Ashen, and he apparently was puzzled by her behavior. But if you read through the story and look at, you know, in between the lines, she was smart, and women weren't supposed to be smart in those days. And so he made reference to her being more like, having more of a mind of a man than that of a woman. And it's like people
yeah.
grew arms and legs off that story.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is, to some extent, that goes to some of the why she's still a compelling person to write about and read about, is that she is, you know, she doesn't fit into a mold of, you know, ideas we might have about what a queen ought to be, ought to have been. And, you know, she didn't, to contemporaries either, she was, you know, by all accounts, formidable.
Right.
I think it was the Venetian ambassador, one of the continental ambassadors, you know, wrote back, you know, within a few days of her becoming queen and comparing her to Mary, saying that, unlike Mary, Elizabeth is to be feared as much as her father was. She, you know, when she knows what she wants, she absolutely gets her way. Whereas Mary was kind of quite weak is a bit un- decisive and irresolute kind of person. And obviously she had Philip of Spain as a husband who was, which obviously had you know, a lot of political and other complications for her at court and elsewhere.
Right,
but Elizabeth never had that. I mean, I think this is, goes to the heart of why Elizabeth wanted to, didn't want to marry, amongst other things.
Right.
It's the,
well, I want to, we need to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to look at some of the stuff in the book here, because the book is a really fascinating read. It's nonfiction, but for me, it kind of, it reads like fiction. It just pulled me straight through. And I learned a lot about this time period by reading your book, Matthew. So my guest is Matthew Lyons, a historian. He's joining us from England today. His book is called The Favourite, Raleigh and His Queen. And you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. We'll be right back.
I want to thank my mommy for loving me so much.
For taking me to the doctor when I broke my foot.
For leaving me alone when I wanted to be alone.
And now, as a grown-up, I'm thankful for being able to take care of you, my dear mom. For taking you to your therapies. For understanding that sometimes you simply want to be alone.
Roles change without us noticing. That's why AARP gives you the information to provide even better care for your loved one. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
If you love dogs, tune in to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, live every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll talk about everything dog and interview authors, experts, and amazing organizations, both locally and nationally. And don't even get me started on the pet food industry. I'm Julie Forbes. Find us online at www.dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, stop self-sabotage once and for all by taming your outer child with psychotherapist Susan Anderson. Also, Vicky talks food junkies and the truth about food addiction with medical director Dr. Vera Tarman. Keep up with show news on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And be sure and tune in every Monday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net. Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair has a new Facebook page, so you can see what's happening on our show and what we're up to between shows. Like us on Facebook and look out for upcoming contest drawings.
Negativity and fear, two staples of talk radio. Well, we figured we'd try something different. Alternative Talk 1150.
Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and my guest in this segment is Matthew Lyons. He's a British historian and writer, and just to quickly recap the story, I connected with him last year. A couple of years ago, I interviewed Steve Berry about his new book, well, it was new back then, The King's Deception, and he'd put a subplot in that book based on a visit to England where he said, I always ask if there are any secrets or mysteries. And the docent in the cathedral in Cambridgeshire told me there's nothing at Ely, but I've heard an incredible rumour in the Cotswolds. And that's what we're talking about today, the fact that that rumour said Elizabeth the First was in fact a man, and that the whole of the British kingdom was duped, and ramifications down the line could be severe. But our historian here says, no, that's not true. Can't be more blunt than that, right, Matthew?
No. I mean, it's inconceivable, really. It really is. You know, there are lots of kind of good conspiracy theories out there, or better conspiracy theories out there, with Richard III or, you know, King Harold or whatever, but this one is just too far-fetched. So, and there's just no evidence whatsoever, really no evidence.
No, and I want to talk a little bit about your book, because you've written a book called The Favourite, Raleigh and His Queen. This came out in 2011, I believe. What fascinated you? I mean, I can understand, having read your book, what fascinated you, but for those who haven't, why did you find Elizabeth so fascinating? I said to you during the break, you know, what struck me when I was reading this, what she went through and what she had to deal with on a daily basis, and not just her, but other people at the same time. If you wrote a fiction book and included all of those happenings, people would say that is so far-fetched. It's totally unrealistic. It's not believable. Yeah. But that's how she lived. That's what they were living in. So
it's interesting, actually, because I originally set out to write a book about Raleigh. And she just sort of demanded to be written about. You know, I felt that the more I wrote, the more I felt that she needed to be written about more, and I needed to, you know, explain her a lot more in terms of their relationship. You know, because it sort of goes down as kind of like one of history's great love affairs or whatever. But her role in it is often... It often comes across as not particularly human. And what I really wanted to do with the book, for both of them, was to get across the kind of human choices that they were making about their own security, their happinesses, their ambitions. And I mean, as you say, her life was, you know, from when her father executed her mother, you know, when she was three, through when she was endlessly negotiated about. I think from the age of four, she was being touted about the courts of Europe as a possible, you know, marriage candidate.
She really was a commodity, wasn't she?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, like all other royals, but particularly so for her, because she, you know, with the execution of her mother, she was, you know, very much cast out of favour, and, you know, was declared illegitimate. So she was both commodity and also something kind of to be got rid of, or to be, I suppose, contained and made safe, you know, by being married to some European count or you know, wealthy duke somewhere. And actually, as you go on through Edward VI's reign and Mary's reign, that idea of marrying her to control her became quite explicit in some of the negotiations that went on. And I suppose particularly in Mary's reign, after she was involved or allegedly involved in the Wyatt Rebellion against Mary and her husband Philip I.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you know, she went to the Tower for that and could easily have been executed. There were plenty of people at court, certainly foreign ambassadors and Spanish advisors who thought Mary should have had her executed. And Elizabeth certainly thought she was going to be executed. Lady Jane Grey had been, I think, executed the month before, and when Elizabeth was in the Tower, you know, the scaffold was still up there, and there's evidence on several occasions she thought, you know, when numbers of guards came in or whatever, that she was about to die. So she, you know, the level of, I suppose, fear is the wrong word, but the level of pressure she had to deal with from a very, very young age, you know, psychological and other pressures, psychological and emotional pressures, are really extraordinary. And then when she comes to the throne herself, she is, you know, the problems just multiply, not problems, but the challenges just multiply and multiply. You know, the kingdom had no money, we were at war with France and extremely bad relationships with Scotland. There was, you know, obviously the question, should she marry? You know, I think it was assumed really by everyone that she would marry, because that's what women did, and that's certainly what monarchs did, because they needed to ensure the succession. And, you know, obviously, where they were in, you know, late 1550s,
right.
The Wars of the Roses probably were out of living memory just about, but certainly if you look back at English history over the previous 150, 200 years, the idea of a secure succession was pretty important.
Right.
So, yeah, and you know, and also the intense pressure she had at court. court. Surrounded by powerful men.
Matthew, we're right at the end of our segment. I hate to cut you off there because I could talk about this for hours, and I really appreciate the insights that you brought into this. And she certainly was a super strong woman. And I just want to read this quote from the book that you included. She says, "My life is in the open, and I have so many witnesses that I cannot understand how so bad a judgment can have been formed of me." And I think your book put that right. I think, I was really intrigued. And like I said, it read like fiction, even though it's nonfiction, and extremely well researched. And I so appreciate your time today coming to talk to us about this. The book is called The Favorite, Raleigh and His Queen. And our listeners can find out more about you at matthewlyons.co.uk. And Matthew has one T, matthewlyons.co.uk. Thanks so much for being with us. We have to run. I'm going to get booted out of the studio here right at the end. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you next week. Until then, live well, live strong. Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.